Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Welcome into the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. Got a good show today, folks. We're getting back to basics today. We are going to be talking about ghosts, apparitions, life after death. We're talking about, more specifically, about what it is we see at the time of death. Let's talk about apparitions today. Let's talk about what happens both on the living side of death and the death side of death or the dead side of death. You know, it's funny when I've had a few of my relatives pass away, I've happened to have had weird experiences all the way from when my great-grandfather passed away, being on the ceiling, being out of body and watching him pass away, his physical form pass away, to when my grandpa Lasker passed away. I saw a vision of a shooting star going from Earth to the heavens, having an actual experience of that happening. Wow. Two experiences that, and I knew at that moment when Grandpa Lasker passes away, I wake up, I go to my phone, and no more than 5 minutes later, my mother's calling me saying, "Your grandfather passed away," and I just tell her, "I know, I'll be over shortly." It's just that quick. And I knew at that point that it had happened, which is eerily similar to an experience that's in the book that our author that's on today, Daniel Bork, has in his new book, Apparitions at the Moment of Death. And when I read that, I went, "Ooh, wow, I got chills." But and as I thought to myself, you know, I thought maybe it was unusual. It's not. There are so many examples from history in this wonderful book that, you think to yourself, you're unusual. You're when something like this happens to you, and you're not. You're absolutely not. There's so many examples in this wonderful book, Apparitions at the Moment of Death, The Living Ghost in Legend, Lyric, and Lore. Let's bring in our guest now, Daniel Bork. Daniel Bork is an author, poet, and songwriter. He has a background in the natural sciences, the arts, and video game industry. He has previously been published in the Journal of the Society for Psychical Research, New Dawn Magazine, and the journal Dark Lore. He lives in Dublin, Ireland. I'm a little jealous of that, but hey, I'm going to not let my jealousy reign here. Let's bring him in. Daniel, welcome in to Darkness Radio.
Thanks very much, Tim. I appreciate the invite. I'm happy to be here. Well, those were some fascinating experiences, by the way, to open the show with.
I mean, it's not anything I haven't told here on the show before. First time you hearing it, of course. I tell them kind of matter-of-factly, maybe. We've all had... I shouldn't say we've all had, because you do have a chapter in this book having to do with people who see and people who may not necessarily see, right?
Yeah. First thing I thought of when you started speaking, actually, because you spoke to having multiple experiences, which is interesting and relatively rare. So yeah, that's kind of interesting. You would have fit perfectly into that chapter.
Yeah, and I suppose we could start at that point. I guess some people, if we want to use the term, some people aren't blessed to have those experiences at all. Some people wander this earth and say, "I wish I could see something." And then there are people who, say, "Oh, no, I see quite regularly." And I don't remember what the quote was from the book, but it had something to do with just simply, was it peeling your eyes or just having the eyes open to see? And I don't remember who the quote was from, or having the eyes open. Do you remember?
Not specifically, but I know there are a dozen similar quotes in that section to do with relating to the fact that in many different cultures, there are different terminologies in order to kind of designate or delineate between those who can see and those who cannot see. Like it could be somebody who has the four eyes in a certain African tribe, for example. It could be someone in Scotland who has second sight, for example. This is kind of an ancient idea, the idea of the seer versus the layman, the saint versus the kind of average Joe in the public. There, the shaman especially, for example, is said to consort with the dead and be able to make contact with the dead. And it's not just that he can do that or she can do that, it's that often it is that capacity which is kind of in the first place the reason why they take that path. And that could come in the kinds of experiences that we're speaking about right now, these crisis apparitions. So that is a very interesting kind of separation that comes out not only through history, but kind of as you're actually evidence of, is that it's very much ongoing. Like, in other words, whatever these experiences literally are, whatever somebody wants to call them, certain people have them and certain people don't. And it seems to be related to some form of capacity to have them. And who knows why everyone doesn't? I've always been of the opinion that maybe it would be far less fascinating if everyone had the same experience. Who knows? Maybe certain people are chosen at certain times for certain reasons related to kind of the needs of their existence. And even the point that you spoke to is interesting, because you said there are many people wandering this earth who wish they could see. And oftentimes one of the criticisms leveled at these types of experiences is that they come about due to people's kind of wishes and dreams and desires, and that will explain it. But as you just alluded to, you know, the majority of people do wish for these experiences and they do not have them. And that's why it's kind of more fascinating. It speaks even more deeply to the mystery of why these occur at all in the first place.
Daniel, let me throw this point at you, because, you know, it seems like in the paranormal, you have the extremely skeptic side of things. You've got, I mean, and let's face it, TV has pushed this to the forefront and maybe over the edge to the cynic, if you will. And you have people who will say, well, you know, a lot of this could have to do with people, you know, people seeing things as you know, having to do with a mental defect or mental illness or you know, and the people who aren't seeing things, let's face it, the reason they're not seeing things is because they're in the norm. And I've been doing this show now for coming up on 19 years. I've had my belly full of that. I've gotten plenty of that. Explain to me, as you wrote this book, and when you look down history, and you've done a wonderful job of documenting from the beginning of time to now, of people seeing apparitions, and as you put it, crisis apparitions, why is it from the beginning of history to now, it hasn't been questioned when you see a ghost, but now in this day and age, if you see one, well, there might be a mental defect. Why do we think that in this age of science, we think we know better than they did from the beginning of history to now?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I wouldn't say the age old question, but certainly for the last, since the Enlightenment, and certainly for the last 200 years, there has been this skepticism surrounding experiences that cannot be easily approached by the empirical methods of science. I think that's the primary issue. And it wasn't just the paranormal, the so-called paranormal that kind of came up against this these barriers when it came to kind of justifying the existence of the field, etc. Other disciplines such as psychology too, it took them a long time to justify their existence in the face of the kind of prevailing academia of the time. But like today, a lot of the kind of skepticism relating to the ghost experience in general, is it's always kind of an ongoing thing. But when it comes to the crisis apparition specifically, it's very interesting in relation to that broader conversation, because just to give anyone new to the idea a kind of primer, is that the reason why the crisis apparition is so fundamentally interesting in and of itself, let alone in relation to the other types of ghost experience, is that the individual experiences the apparition, for example, the apparition of a loved one, often lifelike, often brief, unembellished encounter, and they soon discover that the individual in question had died at that very moment. And what's interesting there is that it's very challenging, if not impossible, to ascribe that experience solely to the mind of the individual, to the wishes and wants and expectations of the individual, because they did not know that they were actually observing a dead person. And furthermore, in the most ideal cases, there was no expectation in the mind of that individual that the person who appears to them were even in danger of dying, or ill for that matter at all. So you're dealing with something that in some way, at least in some manner, contravenes the type of dynamic you mentioned when it comes to the skepticism. And it's not to say that people can't be skeptical of it or haven't been, but I will say that there hasn't been much skeptical work in this area. In fact, in the last 50, 60, 70 years, there hasn't been much kind of meaningfully progressive work in this area, even from the parapsychological side of things, in my opinion. But when it comes to the skeptical side of things, I can only, off the top of my head, I do not remember his first name, but a guy called Worley, W-O-E-R-L-E-E. So he wrote a paper, which was a critique of a guy's paper called Dr. Bruce Grayson. Now, Dr. Bruce Grayson works with near-death experiences, and he wrote a fascinating paper in 2010, which actually was part of the impetus for this book. It was called Seeing People Unknown to Have Died. And so my point just being there, we can go into that paper, et cetera, but my point there is that there has been very little approach to this specific topic, at least in kind of academic circles, in terms of a skeptical viewpoint. So in a way, it is an interesting in that regard.
Let's talk about Dr. Bruce Grayson's paper and the impetus for writing this book. What was it about Dr. Grayson's paper that sparked you into wanting to write this book?
Absolutely. And I'll kind of be a bit clearer there, is that I had always been I had been interested in near-death experiences specifically, probably for about 15 years or so. And I always found them fascinating, and I came across the work of Grayson, and I was aware of the crisis apparition as a phenomenon because I had read the likes of Camille Flammarion, a French astronomer and parapsychologist, among other things, and the likes of the kind of late 19th century parapsychological works on the topic. So I was aware of the phenomenon, but Bruce Grayson wrote this paper. And in that paper, it was during the near-death experience that people were attaining the knowledge of the distant death. So in other words, they would be proclaimed clinically dead. Somebody they know, and at rarer times somebody they don't know, would happen to have died during the period of their clinical death, two unrelated events. But when they come back from that period, they actually relate to those around them that this individual has died, because during the near-death experience, commonly we meet deceased relatives. That's very common. We meet them either in this kind of either before, during, or after the experience, around the deathbed, in the other world as it seems to be, or just on the way back from it. But in these cases, they meet relatives that they didn't know were deceased, yet were actually deceased. So they come back with that information, and actually some of those experiences are often actually the impetus for kind of clinicians and physicians to either kind of take up the task of looking into them more, or commonly, those are the specific types of experiences which they would consider to be the reason why these experiences are evidentiary of survival. But specifically in relation to the paper, Grayson included a couple of cross-cultural examples there. I think he mentioned a Navajo Indian account, and he mentioned an account from Pakistan, for example. And it was then that it kind of clicked, where I kind of looked for more cross-cultural examples, and I realized they weren't really there. So I decided, okay, I will maybe look for 20 or 30 examples, write a little paper and kind of be done with it. But as happens often, I simply couldn't stop finding these accounts. And frankly speaking, because of the extent to which I understood this as a real phenomenon, whatever its explanation, it's a real phenomenon. It occurs to very much ordinary people. Speaking back to your original point, anyone who takes a intellectually honest reading of either this book or the bibliography will know that the individuals who have these experiences are just you and me. They're the ordinary average person, and they often don't even speak about them or want attention for them, etc., etc. There are obviously exceptions, but that is certainly not the rule. But again, the book just grew out of that. Just to be clear again, I didn't actually initially mean it to be a book, but mm-hmm. As I said, the accounts just kept coming, and here we are today, basically.
Right, and you've done a wonderful job, Daniel, of pointing out this doesn't happen just in one race, it doesn't happen in one tribe, it doesn't happen in one sect across the world. It is happening across the world. It's happening in every race, creed, religion. What I found fascinating, though, is there's one particular, not more than just one, but there's one particular one that keeps coming back in my mind when I read the book, and that's the Sufis. The Sufis keep coming back to me, and I'll tell you why. Now, people on this show probably get a little tired of me talking about it. I have Templar heritage, so when I hear Sufis, I know for a fact that Templars and Sufis had a bit of a intermingling in their history. Mm-hmm. So when I hear about the Sufis, I'm fascinated by their culture and a bit about their mystical culture. So as these bits were coming up about the Sufis, I was reading more about the paranormal side and what they were running into. And I found the bits that you wrote about them very fascinating.
I would recommend you follow up on the bibliography in relation to the Sufi accounts, because there are so many others.
Yeah,
it's a quick note there.
It was, and I will definitely. It was their mystical journeys seemed very much different, and yet. It seemed to me that they had quite a few of them. Like it wasn't an unusual thing to them. Like it just seemed like, you know, if it happened, it was just a vision, or it was just an apparition, or it was, you know, it seemed like more than one thing would happen. You know, they'd get a vision.
Yes.
Well, then that was just something that was to be. If it was an apparition that happened, well, it just so happened that one of our villagers had died. He happens to be over there. His body happens to be over there. We're going to go find him. It was just a part of life. It wasn't this big crisis. Why is it that in the Western world, this is a huge crisis to us when someone dies? In the East, this is life. We just pick up and we move on.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point, and it's something that comes up a lot in the book. This idea that, like, for some cultures, there are specific examples in the book we could look to. For instance, the example of on the HMS Beagle, which is the boat that Darwin traveled between Europe and the Tierra del Fuego. He had brought a native of Yamana. A Yamana native from Tierra del Fuego across the waters. But on the way back, this man, his name was Jemmy Button. And on the way back, he told to, after his two shipmates kind of noticed he seemed a bit in the down, a little bit different, something seemed a bit off, he was quieter than usual. They asked him, and he said that during the night, a dark, unrecognized figure had stooped over his bedside and told him specifically that his father had died. And that speaks real, as a side note, that speaks to the fact that in many of these accounts, they're delivered by a third party, not the apparition as such, which is also interesting. But getting back to the account, they found that he had in fact died during the time that they were away, during the time of the vision. But speaking to your point, Jemmy didn't find anything unusual about this. He didn't find it surprising. It was a matter of course that something of this type might occur. And like, when you really think about that, it kind of speaks deeply And speaking to your question in terms of the West, like, it kind of speaks deeply or more deeply to the difference in both the cultures' sense of the cosmos as a whole. In other words, like, if for the Yamana, it wouldn't be surprising that the cosmos, that the universe, that we are connected to each other and to the universe in this way. It's natural that these kinds of lines of communication are open. Mm-hmm. And there isn't, not only are experiences like this, not only when they have experiences like this, do they back that up for them, but they could be the source of these types of beliefs in the first place. You know, you're not without foundation, especially if you're in a culture that practices different types of shamanism and altered states of consciousness, wherein, you know, often these types of, these heightened mystical, often mystical states, one of the common kind of things that often comes from that is that kind of gnosis, that oneness, that feeling that everything is connected. And like that, it's interesting to see that reflected in the reaction to the accounts, and especially in relation to, I'll make 2 points here also, in relation to your question, is that yes, in many cases, in fact, I specifically in that chapter show cases where in the West, in modern collections, books, for example, from 2010 or 2006, just to take two examples, the works of Rodney Bam or the Guggenheims, for example, sorry, 1996, that's the Guggenheims, you will see the surprise, you will see the shock that something of this kind could happen. And I will say that that speaks, first of all, that speaks to the extent that we don't really have this, our culture doesn't really have this easy way to assimilate those experiences, because they're not spoken about in the open. There's this kind of, depending on where they occur, in England, for example, this kind of more secular approach, or different parts of Europe, there isn't that natural scheme wherein you can fit these experiences. However, I will also say that there are different cultures and places in the Midwest, for example, of America. There are many folklore journals there wherein the reactions to these types of experiences are actually similar to the types we just spoke about in these traditional societies. These tokens, these omens. In Canada, they're called forerunners. In Scotland, they're called wraiths. Here in my own country, fetches. There are actually different elements of culture. Now, again, these are more in relation to 50 years ago, maybe 60, 70 to 100 years ago, but that you'll see the same reactions. The sighting of the apparition, the sighting of the ghost, the experience itself often tips off the individual, and they will speak aloud and say, oh, I think this means such and such is actually dead now. So while those would be the exceptions to what is now our rule, as you referenced, the opposite is what used to be true. There were actually even exceptions then, but then the acceptance of its normality was the rule. And we don't have to believe that these experiences reference the reality of the afterlife to admit and speak about the fact that they're real and ongoing experiences. They are a natural part of the human encounter with life and death, and they kind of deserve to be spoken of at least in those terms, and maybe as the book kind of suggests, maybe something more.
Is there also this point as well, Daniel, that in the East, as you mentioned, there's this connectedness to the cosmos, and then it seems like here in the West, and you've pointed it out brilliantly in the book as well, here in the West, I think with Western religion, we've separated ourselves from God with saints. And we've put ourselves, you know, we've put holy men and other stages between us and God. So you've got to go through levels, right? It's almost like a video game. We got to go through different levels in order to get to God, right? So there's a lack of connectedness to God. We have different levels we have to go through. So for us, we're not directly connected to the cosmos. So we've almost disconnected from the cosmos. Mm. So we've done that to ourselves. So it is a shock.
Interesting.
Right? I mean,
That's fascinating. Yeah, great point.
But you in the book, and I don't mean to interrupt, but even you in the book,
go ahead,
say that there are certain saints, our own saints, that have had these experiences where...
So many.
Yeah. One in particular in the book where I believe there's a saint that was something like 20 some miles away, and there were a bunch of other, I think it was a brother monk has a vision, goes to find this other saint that's in this cave. I'm trying to remember the particular tale, but has a vision that he's going to die, or he has died. They go to check on him. Sure enough, there he is. He's laying in a stone coffin. Is that the story I think I have?
Maybe it sounds right, but there's so many Saint accounts in the book.
That's right.
That it's hard to remember.
But I think I might have it close. If
you sound like you've about nailed it, though. Yeah.
That's but even then, we're talking about saints that are having visions that are connected to the cosmos. So if the saints are connected to the cosmos, why aren't we? Right? I mean, why do we deny ourselves and put levels between us and God when the saints didn't do it?
Such an interesting point, especially from that's a very, very interesting, because of course we have to remember that the saint isn't necessarily born a saint. You know, the saint becomes a saint. Mm-hmm. Saint is canonized. But the point there is that, but in other words, they're having these experiences before they're canonized. They're having these experiences, for instance, there was an account in the book from the English Saint Cuthbert, and he turned out to be one of England's most famous, well-known saints. I believe it was the 5th century. It was his experience, his crisis apparition, or rather, it was more of a vision. It was, and funny enough, the account that you mentioned in your own life, and you said it reminded you of accounts in the book, it was very similar to these saints' accounts in many cases. Like you mentioned even seeing a star moving upwards. There are specific examples in the book of those accounts related to the passing of famous people, or even certain witch doctors among the Aboriginals, for example. But with Cuthbert, this experience itself, this crisis vision, was actually the impetus for him to set upon the monastic path in the first place. This is very interesting, very powerful, because it speaks to, what's interesting is that it's not just these experiences aren't just consistent through time in the actual aspect of the experience, but even the after effects, even the fact that it's implied in this life of the saint that this experience was so powerful that it actually turned him to that path. And we find that today, and especially you'll see at the end of the first chapter, there are many accounts wherein the individual notes that it was this experience specifically that bolstered my belief in the persistence of consciousness after death, but not just bolstered, in some cases actually instantiated that belief in the first place. And this comes full circle to the fact that I believe that the crisis apparition, I don't know how much of a role, but I believe it had a role to play in this instantiation of afterlife beliefs among at least certain individuals. And I think I can say that confidently because we know that it occurs today. And so your point is very well taken. And the number of accounts in the lives of the saints, it's fascinating in this also, because while there have been some allusions made, even the work of Calme, a French, it's one of the most famous works on ghosts, basically. I've forgotten the name, my apologies, but it's Calme, and he's a French researcher, and he will make just vague references to, for instance, there are some examples like this in the lives of the saints, and you'll find that throughout the kind of parapsychological literature. But once I started realizing just how many there were, and the specific idiosyncratic similarities they had to modern accounts, I thought I needed to document much more of these. And thankfully, I got a lot into the book, but there are many, many more.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, when we come back, we're going to take our break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about things like tokens, angels, totems. I want to talk about actual symbols, things that people see that we may be taking from the other side, and why we're seeing these things. And why, again, why some people see them, why some people don't, what we're picking up on, different stories about these things. And different things about that. I also want to talk about near-death experiences and journeys to heaven and hell, and a little bit about why some people see a bright light, why some people don't have such a great experience. Our guest is Daniel Bork. The book is absolutely fascinating, folks. I encourage you to pick it up. It's called Apparitions at the Moment of Death, The Living Ghost in Legend, Lyric in Lore. And it's available right now. We have a link in the description of this program. Folks, I tell you, if you're wanting any type of ghost story, this is ghost stories from the beginning of time to now. This is chock-a-block full of any type of ghost story you can imagine. It is the perfect book for any ghost story lover in your family for the holidays. I encourage you to pick up a copy of it. We've got a link in the description of this program. More with Daniel Bork when we come back right here on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. My guest is Daniel Bork. He has a wonderful new book out there. It's called Apparitions at the Moment of Death, The Living Ghost in Legend, Lyric, and Lore. Again, everything from crisis apparitions, a ghost appearing at the time of its death, to tokens, angels, near-death experiences, everything you can imagine from the beginning of history to now. Lots of different examples, great stories from history. So many that I think of different examples. I want to bring up different examples and I go, and then there's that one. And Daniel, I can't put my finger on one to bring up. There's so many. I mean, you've done such a great job of farming so many different stories from history, but it's one of those ones. And this is one of those books that, I mean, literally, if you had to pick up one book to contain so many stories that you could tell friends, hey, you know, there's this one story from history. This is that one book. This literally is that one source book that people can go to. So you've done a wonderful job at putting that particular book together. So I tip my hat to you for that.
Appreciate that.
Before the break, I was teasing. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about symbols and tokens, and you mentioned in the book about people having dreams and having symbols, that things like a woman having a dream about an eagle attacking a falcon, and then something happening the next day, like somebody being attacked and then falling.
That was a Russian poem, I believe.
Yeah, Russian poem, right. The thing is sometimes those dreams you would think, and again, this is the skeptic that I get the skeptic side all the time when you know, people say, oh, well, certain things had to happen in order for that dream to come true, right? Well, that was just happenstance. Happenstance is that word that always gets thrown out, right?
Well, it's a helpful word. It's a helpful word to not have to engage.
Right, right. But a lot of times, and a lot of the stories that you point out, a lot of times these events are happening right after these visions or after these dreams. It's like boom, boom, right? It's not they have this dream and then 3 weeks later it happens, or they have this vision and, you know, a month later something happens. It's right on top of it.
That's
get the message and it happens, right?
Sorry, there's like a slight delay, so I didn't mean to cut across there.
No, you're fine.
But like, yeah, you're right. There's this. That's kind of why these experiences are so fundamentally fascinating. Is that they're not always exactly coincident with the distant death, but they commonly are. And like at times, the exact time of death was the very time of the vision or the dream. And you kind of spoke to this symbolism and the like. Let me give you an example. Like Aniela Jaffe, for example, a Jungian psychologist. She wrote a book called Apparitions and Precognition, I believe in the 60s. Very interesting book. I'd recommend everyone reads it. It relates accounts of this kind, often from Switzerland, some from Germany, and some other references too. But it's primarily a Swiss sample. But in there, she kind of goes through, for instance, oftentimes the apparition will be seen to be about to leave on a journey or to be waving goodbye and referencing where they're going to go, for example. And Jaffe kind of comes at this from this kind of Jungian psychological kind of symbolic perspective of like, oh, this apparition is kind of representing this ancient, well-established death imagery, and like kind of speaks to the symbolism but then moves on. However, Jaffe doesn't address, and as a lot of skeptics don't, is that, okay, that's fair enough, we can have that conversation, but that has nothing to say on why the experience occurred exactly at the moment of the distant death. Does the individual have these deep Jungian related symbolic dreams every night? Probably not.
Yeah.
So why is it that it occurred? Not only why is it that it occurred at the exact moment of the distant death, but why was the apparition actually displaying highly specific and idiosyncratic characteristics referencing death itself? So it's, in other words, like this again, this is something that I speak about as something that has been a little overlooked, is that the apparition often in these Christ apparitions, they don't just display that they're dead or imply that they're dead in obvious ways. For instance, waving goodbye, or frankly speaking, they sometimes just tell what's happening, I've died, very simply, and then move on. They often actually display that the fact that they're dead in ways that are so idiosyncratic that even the individual to whom they're appearing may not be aware that these are ways in which the dead appear. And I'll be specific on that and say that, for example, to take one example, we know that during the near-death experience and during many other encounters with the deceased, whether it's a deathbed vision, whether it's an after-death communication, we know that they very commonly, for whatever reason, something that still hasn't been looked into very deeply, by the way, they appear younger, often decades younger. They often appear in their prime. Their hair is no longer gray, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The illness that kind of riddled the body before death has been kind of pulled back and they have their youthful form again. So in and of itself, this is mysterious and something that we haven't really looked into. But you could you could, if off the top, you could make a back of the envelope argument that it's related to the individual's sense of what might constitute an afterlife, the fountain of youth, you know, this kind of ideal place where we become younger. The problem is, during the crisis apparition, often the apparition also appears decades younger. So this is something that's very powerful when we think about the coincidence here. It's not just that the apparition is appearing, as the book suggests, at the moment of death. Is they're actually displaying deeply specific idiosyncratic characteristics that we know apply to deceased persons, despite the fact that the individual didn't know they were looking at a deceased person. So the mystery truly thickens, because in the early days, certain individuals, George Turrell in the 50s, brought mathematics to bear. He was a mathematician, and he brought statistical analysis to bear on these accounts. And while he criticized some of the earlier work in that regard, he did conclude that when you look at the specifics of the apparition, the timing, etc., chance coincidence was mathematically improbable. Okay, so it was unlikely that these experiences were coincidental. But even the likes of Turrell didn't factor in the kinds of idiosyncrasies that I'm speaking about here, and there are many of them. The fundamental mystery of the Christ apparition actually is deeper than kind of has been known to this point, in my opinion.
Interesting. Also interesting, as you're talking about crisis apparitions, my screen flashes and then comes back. I don't know why. Yeah. No. I mean, it kind of weird stuff as it happened. But I mean, I don't think you noticed it, but you completely whited out and a white Zoom screen came up and then went away.
Oh, God, this better not be an apparition at the moment of my death.
No, I don't think it is.
I hope high posthumous book sales, hopefully.
I think it should. I would hope it would. But I don't think I've ever told, I've told our audience this, but I don't think I mentioned it to you before we started taping, Daniel, is that I actually do have a ghost here in the house.
Okay.
It's the ghost of the former owner. And so I don't know if he's messing with me, but I don't know. I'm not going to get all paranoid on you or anything like that, but.
What's interesting there, if I may, that actually speaks to something interesting in relation to these accounts, is that I do stress the moment of death. And originally, the kind of definition of a crisis apparition arrived at was 12 hours before or after the death. However, the kind of ghost that you speak of, the kind of classic hunter type ghost, those are interesting. Although the book is called Apparition at the Moment of Death, my kind of deeper interest is general non-ordinary intimations of a distant death, okay? And that can be distant either in space or time. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's interesting, these hunter ghosts, like the kind of ghosts you speak of, are you have these encounters where the individual maybe spots the type of, they have an experience where they report seeing the ghost of somebody. It may be a man who looks like he's dressed in clothing from a different period. It may be somebody who's just, but the point I'm making is that they then later discover by whatever means, whether it's a photograph, whether it's a video, whether it's somebody, the former house owner's knowledge, that individual was a real person and they have actually died in that house. The point there that I'm making is that even then, the individual is discovering a distant death. That's the way they come to know that death. So the timing of the 12 hours before and after is helpful, but it doesn't discount your experience. As long as you came to the knowledge that this death occurred and can kind of confirm it, then yeah, you've still had a kind of a similar and relevant experience, in my opinion.
The gentleman in this house, I had to come to kind of an agreement with him. It seems weird, but it's one of those things where he was very partial to the house. He helped build this house. So it was one of those things where we just agreed to coexist together, right? As odd as it sounds. And yes. But it's this was kind of his area. This was kind of his area where he was happiest, right? So I guess he takes an interest in my work every once in a while, but I think when it hits too close to home, he gets a little defensive. So I think I just need to tell him to settle down and we'll put on a ball game later and he'll be fine. That seems to be the thing that settles him down. We put on sports.
That's interesting. Like one of the, like what you just said there, like that's the common refrain, is that the individual such as yourself report that they're kind of, the ghost was like kind of unhappy now that somebody else is here and this is their place, and it's kind of like this repudiation of the new person coming in. So it's just interesting that your account kind of tallies with the broader literature in that regard. It's fascinating.
I think it's just, it's the hitting close to home, the reminder that you're here but you're not type deal, right? I know I'd be a little irate, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Being reminded of something I used to have that I don't need more. I mean, I kind of enjoy life. I'm not going to lie, right? I mean, this is kind of a cool existence. I know some people are like, oh, my day-to-day life, it fucking sucks, blah, 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 right? But not me. I'm, you know, I mean, pardon the language, but I'm a guy who enjoys life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really do. You know, I love you. Yeah, I love talking to people. I love everything about life. And maybe maybe it's part of being an old soul and having done this a few times. But I just enjoy the hell out of everything. So
that's really cool. I love that because it is a kind of a. It almost seems taboo to say I enjoy life today.
Yeah, right? Everybody's in a bad mood, but really no, I mean, you know, when you look at the brighter side of things and look at the good side of people, it's a little more enjoyable. Right?
There's a lot of you know, beauty out there. A lot of wonder. And it may not get the kind of, it's very easy, obviously, to get bogged down in the negative stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of extraordinary kind of mystery and wonder out there. And I think that if there's one thing that I would like people to actually take from this book, it's to remember that. It's to remember that there are things we don't know. That's actually, ignorance is kind of a powerful thing because it allows us to wonder. It allows us to have that awe, that childish awe. Like, what does this mean? You know, what is the kind of real, true nature of things? And I think these kind of accounts actually can potentially open up those types of thought processes in people. And they certainly did in me, you know, and they certainly do in the individuals who have them. You know, in a moment, you have to remember how brief these accounts often are. They're very often, you know, we're talking seconds to a minute, sometimes minutes, rarely longer. But in that very small period, something so extraordinary has happened that the individual, their entire sense of their place in the cosmos has been altered. Now, I want to be clear, this isn't always the case, but it seems to be more often the case than not, mm-hmm. that the individual's sense of place in the cosmos has actually changed. Their feeling of its meaning and their relationship to it. Because after all, if this experience is what it's presenting itself as, then it is powerful evidence that the soul continues after this moment that we called death and maybe have hastily considered a moment of finality. And not only that, though, but it can also imply that there is a kind of a scheme to things, a kind of a system. Because obviously, if this is occurring and it occurs systematically in different cultures across space and time, like, if you were to take the interpretation of externality of the phenomenon, then one would assume it's in some way regulated. And what's actually interesting about, so my point there first is that can actually feed into the individual's philosophical ideas right into the universe itself. But regarding the regulation, funny enough, that actually does come out sometimes in the near-death literature. Like, you do find accounts where somebody on a battlefield dies, for example. Two people will say die in a battlefield. One of them ultimately dies, the other comes back, but they both leave their body together. And they're speaking to each other. This is at least what the soldier reported. He was speaking to his dead comrade. He saw both their bodies on the ground. And he told that his comrade, who would ultimately go on to die, and he told him that he had been given time to go and say goodbye to certain people. So in that moment, and that's why he had to leave now. And then he left. So it's almost like this, if you could collect like many more of those accounts, it would be this very interesting kind of corroborative evidence for the crisis apparition as we know it. Because they're appearing to say goodbye, but during these experiences, the individual is being told, I'm actually being told I can go and say goodbye to people. So it's kind of an interesting cross-correlation there.
Wow. You know, we all kind of wonder what that moment, that last moment's going to be like, right? But being told you can go say goodbye. I mean, that, you know, you hear that there's this feeling of euphoria that comes over you, right? That you know, you're going to, you know, at that moment, that if it, when it's truly happening, that you have this feeling of euphoria, like you're going home, like nothing really matters back here, that you can truly leave and again, air quotes, you can see it on video, you can't see it on audio, that you're heading home.
Yeah.
But I always wonder at that point, you know, if you truly wonder about the people you're leaving behind, or if you feel bad about the people you're leaving behind, and if it's, you know, if there is that second thought at that moment of, should I really do this, you know? And
well,
if
I could oh, go ahead. Probably.
Oh no, no. And if you just for a brief second go, well, maybe I should make the decision to stay, or maybe I should try to hold on. Or if you just have no qualms, if it's really your time, if you just go, well, nope, I'm out of here, and you do go say your goodbyes, if you have that strength of soul and go do it and then get out of here. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, that's interesting, because like certainly in the near-death literature, there the variety of responses to that situation that you just kind of alluded to, they all come out in different variations. So although I will say one thing that comes out very commonly that's interesting is that, like, these are experiences, like, it's basically impossible for the individual to impart to us how they felt during these experiences. That's often what comes out. They're ineffable. They're challenging to explain in earthly language. And this can be in the very literal sense too, because they often describe that they saw colors or heard sounds that they had never seen or heard respectively before. So it's not just some kind of metaphorical thing. But what's interesting is that in these accounts, whatever type of rapture these individuals often find themselves in, and it can sound like corny to say this, but the fundamental aspect of the near-death experience is this thing we call love. It's this energy that we call love. That's what comes through. They feel that they're being embraced and being kind of held by not just a love that is kind of recognizable, but something that they often describe goes beyond anything, even with their family, even with their husband, with their children, etc., etc. And it's to the point, and this is speaking directly to your point, it is to the point that in many cases you will read accounts where the individual initially decides, actually, you know what, this is so much bliss, this is so, I have such perspective now, I understand what my life was, I understand that everyone I leave behind will ultimately be okay, because the universe is set up in this particular way that they now realize that actually I'm not going to go back. I've decided that even though I have, you know, I have a family, I have a future, I'm actually not going to go back. That's, you cannot imagine what kind of a choice that is for somebody who has a family, like, unless you have one. But yet they're happy to make that choice. Now, often I will say that in those moments, they are often sent back kind of, they often come to the conclusion that, okay, well, maybe I should go back because, you know, I have this kind of path to take in life, etc. But that's just a kind of a side point to speak to the power of these experiences, such that they actually will sometimes initially make that decision. But yeah, so speaking to the kind of your point about the variety of responses, yeah, there are other responses too. Like the individual will often immediately decide to come back. There is no hesitation. At other times there is hesitation. At other times they will go further into the experience. Some people kind of meet this classic tunnel, but again, other researchers have made it clear that we just call it a tunnel because it's our kind of cultural way of describing it. Other people have called it different things, but some people will make it into this kind of glowing otherworldly landscape, and other people will only leave their bodies and then come during the experience. And something in, and then just pop, come back into their bodies. They may kind of report seeing themselves on the gurney, or they may see themselves in the ambulance. And sometimes they actually report seeing themselves in the operating theater, for example, and, you know, reporting specific idiosyncratic details related to the behavior of those around them, which are later confirmed, which of course is fascinating in and of itself. But yeah, there are, just to kind of summarize, there are a variety of responses, and they're all kind of interesting and fascinating in their own way. And to some extent, it's what we'd expect if this was kind of a human experience, because, you know, we're obviously not all going to react to the moment of death in the same way. Certainly not.
There's one of the scariest near-death experiences that I've ever heard. And again, I won't go through it again here on the show, but I'll encourage you, Daniel, to look it up. Has to do with our good friend John E.L. Tenney out of Detroit, Michigan. He saw nothing but black. He was black. He was the void. And there was nothing. It was just nothing. And he could try to reach out, but there was nothing. He couldn't see his hand. And he had become nothing but nothingness. And he couldn't escape. And the way he tells it, and I think there's I think one or two podcasts in which he tells it online. It is online. It's on YouTube. Is absolutely frightening. And he tells exactly how he got out of it. It is, and to this day, he says, you've never been so alone in your life. You've never been so isolated in your life. And he said, I will never not be around people again.
Wow.
I've come to the point where I never want to be without love. I never want to be without or not around people. Because
connection.
Yeah, because he said I screamed
wow.
I couldn't hear myself scream.
That's powerful.
Yeah,
that really is. And it's I will say this, like, not to kind of discount the experience or anything, in it, from what it could have meant, my initial kind of take on that is it's kind of that maybe in that individual's life, that type of experience was the only way to make him realize how he needed those connections. You know, it sounds to me like the after effect there may be some benefits to that after effect. I could be wrong there, but what you said there kind of is interesting. The guy now kind of, he needs this connection with people. He realizes not just the importance of kind of not being alone and doing things alone, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe, I could be wrong again, obviously I'm just speaking to this, but maybe he has kind of forged some new connections in his life that are kind of important to him, and kind of he may not have even had the capacity to do without this experience. And the reason I say that is because, yes, there are negative near-death experiences and they certainly need to be spoken about, but obviously to some extent negative is a relative term, and it can often reference the moment as opposed to the kind of longer term. Like in some of these experiences, the individual will often look back on the experience and say that, you know, it turns out that I kind of needed it to be this way. It turns out that there were reasons and benefits to this approach. I'm not saying that's always the case, but there does seem to be this kind of, and we can say that about experiences in our own life, can we not? How many times have we suffered in the moment and looked back and realized not just why we've suffered, but, you know, the positive changes that came about in ourselves from this suffering. And I don't mean in any way to diminish suffering by any means, especially on an individual, on a person-to-person basis. I'm just making the point that this is the case. People do report this. And it's just something that needs to be taken into account if we are going to make broad statements on these kind of experiences, because often you will have people say, you know, how could this be a good thing if these negative things occur? But, you know, we're living in a vast, strange, mysterious universe. The rules are beyond my comprehension. So I'm not going to make those definitive claims. I'm going to say that maybe there's a possibility that there is a kind of a regulation going on here. And it's, who knows, maybe related to the individual's, you know, path, their karma. Who knows? I don't know. But yeah, let's not be too hasty with conclusions in that regard is all I would say.
Well, I want to address suffering for a brief sure. moment. If you want to take, whether you want to, I don't care what school of thought you take here and what religion you come from, but if you want to talk about suffering, I heard a beautiful quote once, and it had to do with the passion of the Christ. And take the word passion. Passion didn't come without suffering. Passion always comes with suffering. Passion is not a word of love or beauty. Passion literally means suffering. There's suffering in passion.
Wow.
When you have a passion for something, you suffer. You suffer for your art, right? If you have a passion for art, you suffer for your art. If you have a passion to get ahead for something, You strive for it. You'll die for it. Mm. You'll do whatever it takes to get it. Passion is suffering.
Like, yeah. Right. It's like love, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Love is partly suffering. I mean,
that's right.
You know, that inevitability of its end, it becomes immediately apparent, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, so that's a really interesting, powerful point you made. That kind of, it's not just that suffering may not be bad, it's that it may not even just be suffering. It is this kind of intertwined, kind of complex kind of dance of human kind of emotion and being. And, you know, we are complex beings, of course, so these kind of binary, basic kind of ways of kind of characterizing each other, yeah, it's often not helpful. So that's a really interesting point that you make there.
And there's a reason that that phrase is there, and it's very deliberate. The passion of the Christ is a deliberate statement because he suffered for his people and he died. That's a deliberate statement. That's not just willy-nilly words thrown together.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah,
that's fascinating.
It's a deliberate statement.
So the benefits of suffering are just kind of encoded in there,
right? And ever since I've heard that statement put out there, I've never used the word passion the same way again, because it truly means to suffer for something you love.
Incredible, and you see that a lot in the lives of the saints too, of course.
Yeah.
You know, you see the saints often physically harming themselves, like fasting, you know, purposely imposing suffering kind of in order to kind of emulate that type of passion, in order to kind of also to bring themselves closer to God with altered states, et cetera, et cetera. You know, these types of fasting and self-flagellation, et cetera. So yeah, it is kind of encoded in the monastic path as well. So it is a fascinating point that you make.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
So I want to get back to the negative, as we start to wrap up here today, I do want to get back to the negative near-death experience. Now, when we talk about it, and I want to get back to suffering there, because there's a point to that and changing the mindset of someone who may be on the wrong path. So is that maybe the lesson? Because you know, I hear this a lot from psychics. Oh, there's no such thing as hell. Oh, every time I reach out into the psychic mindscape, I don't see hell. Okay. Well, you know what? People are having these negative experiences. People are reporting seeing dark, hot places and people screaming. And they get the impression that if I don't change things around, this is where I'm going to end up. So why are they seeing this then?
Interesting. If I remember correctly, the statistics seem to suggest that the number of negative near-death experiences and kind of number low, or in and around somewhere between, I believe, 4 and 8%, maybe less, maybe between 3 and 5, but it is low. But in terms of the psychics that you referenced, and like, first of all, you'd have to know what do they mean by hell. What exactly do they mean by hell? Because then we can kind of speak about whether it quote unquote exists or not. Because if you define hell as that 3 to 5% we just mentioned of near death experiences, then of course it absolutely exists, because these people are experiencing it and it's affecting their mental state from that moment on. So again, I kind of will come back to this point of I don't know the rules of the universe, but you could make the argument that for whatever reason, in that moment, in the path of that individual's life, they needed this experience in some sense. Now, again, I don't want to say this is always the case, but it may be the case for some individuals that this kind of extreme moment is the only thing that can kind of almost frighten somebody into a kind of a more beneficial path. Who knows? Almost like, I don't know, an adolescent who needs a kind of a shouting at or something, or a police officer. They've been kind of acting up, and finally they do something a bit too far, and they kind of come within reach of the long arm of the law, and that's their wake-up call. That moment they realize, oh, I'm going down the wrong path here. This is not something I want to continue, because I've had a taste of what it is like if it does. So who knows, on the universal scale, there could be something at work there. I don't know, but I really do believe that it's a possibility.
Yeah. I'd agree with you there. I think much like, I'll bring it back to the whole suffering thing that we brought up earlier. I think if you don't get that real taste, it's much like conditioning, right? When you have to, and I hate to compare us to training an animal or training, you know, having to train an animal at home. But if we don't kind of rub our nose in it a little bit, then maybe we don't get the idea that hey, you know what, this is what we're bound for. If we don't get an idea of the path that we're headed on and where we're about to head to, we don't know to avoid it. And maybe that's what that negative near death experience is. It's, hey, you know what? You don't switch the path you're on. That's the path you're headed for.
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that's very possibly the case. And I'd say that, you know, you can even look to specific cultures who, you know, go out of their way to suffer physically. They go out of their way to experience things close to death. They bring themselves close to death. In some cases, they may clinically die. These kind of traditional cultures, certain shamanic rituals may bring the individual close to death. And like they understood that it's almost like a representation of the fact that suffering as a concept isn't something that is only bad or has to necessarily only be bad. And this is something that a lot of people actually do push back on. You know, they consider that suffering just is bad and that's final. But, you know, I believe that, again, there are, you know, we live in a much more complex, potentially complex universe than that. And mm-hmm. that there is a full spectrum of emotions, which kind of, as you speak to, kind of potentially need to be felt. Like, it's very simple, really, you know. I mean, we know that experiences, we can speak to our own experiences as kind of in the world of the living, if you will. You know, I mean, the individual who experiences the deepest depression, the individual who experiences the greatest anxiety, those are the individuals who can truly empathize now. Those people who come through those experiences, those are the ones who can empathize at a different level and connect on a different level to those other people who are now going through those same experiences. It's the same with the alcoholic sitting down in Alcoholic Anonymous. You know, I think that often the individuals there were alcoholics in a previous life. And, you know, that alone can often be enough to bolster the relationship and the kind of trust between those two individuals. So we have to be really aware that there could be, in the universal scheme, who knows, maybe those individuals who are having these negative near-death experiences are in some way expressing that dynamic in some way. In some way, there'll be now conduits for others to kind of have a different kind of relationship to. Like we spoke about your friend, the guy you spoke about. Who knows, not only the impact that the people, he said he needs new connections. Yeah. Maybe it's not just the impacts that they've had on him, but what impact has he had on their lives? He could have had a beneficial effect on their life too, especially with his kind of, if I can use this term, in with my lack of knowledge of the situation, his more humbled mindset perhaps, you know, this more sense of grounding and down to earth, who knows? So it goes both ways. And we have to, when it comes to these types of experiences, we can't be obsessed with the impacts in the moment and on the individual. And I'm not saying that those aren't important. I want to be clear, but in the grander scheme of things, we have to remember that there are knock-on effects. Every little thing that one person does affects many others, and those people are obviously just as important as you. So who knows? Think about this, like in a grander universal scheme, for all we know, that individual that you spoke of, he was chosen in order to have that experience, come back here and impact, and therefore kind of impact a lot of other people within his circle. And that in and of itself could be justification for the experience in the eyes of this cosmos we find ourselves in. Who knows? I think those things are very possible.
You're absolutely right, Daniel. I mean, you couldn't have put it more succinctly, more brilliantly. You're right. And John's story has reached out to thousands and absolutely chilled them and probably put a lot of people on a different path. Just on the fact that story is very chilling in itself.
Exactly.
The book is absolutely fascinating, folks. I want you to go out and get a copy of it right now. Again, if you have someone out there who's a fan of ghost stories, and a fan of history at that, or maybe just would like to look further into the research of ghosts in general, this is the book for you. Apparitions at the Moment of Death, The Living Ghost in Legend, Lyric, and Lore. There's so much information here, Daniel. You've done such a comprehensive job of putting it all together, such a great job of putting it all together. Again, I highly recommend it for the paranormal lover who out there for the holidays. It's such a great book. So, again, you've knocked it out of the park, my friend. I tip my hat to you. And again, we have a link in the description of this program for people.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I hope for the readers interested, I really hope that it's one of those. I really wanted it to be a book where you could quite literally open it on any page and find a crisis apparition from history. And I think it is one of those books. So I hope that you will you will enjoy it if you choose to pick it up.
Absolutely, absolutely. Again, Apparitions at the Moment of Death, The Living Ghost in Legend, Lyric, and Lore. Daniel Bork, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the invite. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I want to thank Daniel Bork for being on the program today. Apparitions at the Moment of Death, The Living Ghost in Legend, Lyric, and Lore is available right now. We've got a link in the description of this program so you can go get that book. I highly encourage you to get it. It's got so many different stories in it. It's one of those books where literally I think you can find every story that's ever happened in history. I mean, seriously, it's got just about every tale of a run-in with a ghost that you can imagine, and it's a great reference book to have on your shelf. So if you've got that paranormal lover in your family that you want to get a gift for this Christmas, I think it's probably one of those books that you absolutely need to have. So I would highly recommend it. So this week I went out and saw a movie. I figure I'd give you a quick movie review before we get out of here today. Went out and saw a Marvel-adjacent movie. I think that's the only way to put it. Kraven the Hunter. That's a Spider-Man villain, right? For those of you that are familiar with the comic books, Kraven the Hunter, of course, is one of the, I guess you could say, one of the big Spider-Man villains, but really wasn't one of the huge ones or one of the major ones until really the 80s. When it was J.M. DeMatteis who kind of took over Kraven and reinvented him and gave him that killer instinct, which I don't think a lot of people remember that. But Kraven the Hunter was actually reinvented in a way where he, the comic book arc was actually genius, and they've actually taken in the film and incorporated that killer instinct into the film, which I'm glad they did. But they've reinvented the legend in such a way that he's had that killer instinct all along, which I'm glad they have. This Kraven has an edge to him. And I think he will be, much like Venom, has had enough to have a standalone universe. I think this Kraven the Hunter has enough to have a standalone universe as well. I think they've done a very good job of putting him on his own, unlike, God forbid, the Madame Web deal. That one kind of fell apart at the seams. I really think Kraven the Hunter is good enough to do its own universe. I think it was a very good job. I know the lead character, Sergei Kravinoff, who's played by Aaron Taylor Johnson. Aaron Taylor Johnson himself has had a couple of, I don't want to say misfires in the Marvel Universe, but he's played a couple of different characters, including Quicksilver in the Avengers movie. They've tried him in different areas, but it hasn't worked. But this one, he's landed. And I think this one is the one that he's here to stay. Russell Crowe is in this movie and plays Sergei's father, Nikolai Kravinoff, who is his ruthless father, and he does an amazing job as his father. I think, really, this is quite the good movie. Not great, but good. Keep that in mind. I still think that Sony hasn't made that over-the-top Marvel movie yet that's been exceptional without Marvel's help, right? I mean, with Marvel's help, they've made that great movie. But without Marvel's help, they haven't done one that's been over-the-top great. This is very good, though. It is a very good movie and has a very good script. It's got great action. The action is second to none. It's just, there's little bits and pieces here where it could be maybe a little bit better. You can tell it doesn't have the Marvel touch to it. Marvel's always got that little bit of pixie dust, right? Much like Disney, where they put it on there and it's got that little finishing touch and you go, yeah, that's Marvel. And you can tell there's something special to it. It comes close. It comes very close, but there's just a little something there that is just maybe off a bit. But make no mistake, still a very, very good movie, which they do an excellent job of setting Kraven up for a potential showdown down the line. And they set his character up down the line to be an anti-hero. One of those shades of gray characters down the line, which I think he'll be excellent at. They very much set him up as a hero in the beginning of the movie, which when you start to watch the movie, you go, I don't know how he's going to get out of this, right? You don't know how he's going to turn that corner. How they get him to that is brilliant. I think really there are some brilliant twists and turns in this movie. And it's a lot better than the typical Sony films. You know, Morbius was a misstart. Madam Web was a misstart. And they've tripped on a few of the Spider-Man villains. This one, I think they got right. And it's really a tribute to the writers of this movie, Richard Wenk, Art Markham and Matt Holloway, and the director, J.C. Chandor, the fact that they got together and were able to make not just a movie, but a movie with some passion and a movie that has some direction and actually knows the source material. There are definitely some nods to other Spider-Man villains. There's nods to the future of the Spider-Man franchise, which makes me wonder. Now, having talked to a marketing rep at the movie, she had told me that there's no more Sony movies scheduled to come out, which makes me confused because I could swear that Tom Holland has a 2-picture deal in which he's supposed to come back for Secret Wars, but that kind of leaves you up in the air as to why do what they did at the end of the movie. I'm not going to spoil it for you, but why do what they did at the end of the movie to set up future Spider-Man films if there's nothing on deck for Sony? Makes you wonder. But go see it. I'm encouraging you to go see it this weekend. I give it a solid 3.5 out of 5. It's above average movie. I really liked it. I really did like it. And I really do think that Aaron Taylor Johnson, now I've seen him in 2 movies in the past week. And he's been excellent in both. So he is truly a rising star in Hollywood. I think he'll be an excellent dramatic actor. And I think he makes an excellent action star. So go check it out. Kraven the Hunter. Even if you do it at a matinee. If you do it at a matinee, you'll be very pleased. Even if you do it for full price, I think it's a wash. I think either way, you get your money's worth. So if you're looking for just a good shoot 'em up action flick, you're going to get your money's worth. If you're looking for one that's got a deeper story, you'll get the deeper story. So overall, 3.5 out of 5 for me for Kraven the Hunter. And that's just on a regular film scale. It's not even on an action film scale. So there you go. Kraven the Hunter. Check it out this weekend. Opens Friday at a theater near you. All right. We're coming up on the weekend. Be a light in someone's darkness this weekend. Go out and help somebody out this weekend. It's been cold here in the Twin Cities this week. And we are expecting some snow showers, believe it or not. So if you've got the snow plows out there, go out and help somebody, help plow out a driveway. We're coming up on the holiday season as well. So maybe you could contribute to a food shelf. Lots of food shelves out there that need product. So maybe you could go out there and help food shelves. I think it's that time of year where we need to be thinking about our neighbors. So let's do that. Let's get out there and let's mobilize and start to think about our fellow man this time of year. So go out and do that. We have a major guest for True Crime Tuesday coming up on Tuesday. I said I'd tease it on Friday on social media. I still plan on doing that. So let's just put it this way. This person was involved in the trial of the century. I'll leave it at that. This person will be on True Crime Tuesday. They have a brand new book out. And we're going to talk about that book on Tuesday. I'm excited. I can't wait. So it's going to be a good True Crime Tuesday. We're going to have a great week next week. So make sure you tune in next week. In the meantime, be sure to head over to darknessradioshow.com. Check out the store. Also, in the description of this program, you'll see a link for Ghost Stories, Inc. for the trip up at the Palmer. Jessica and Ghost Stories, Inc. have been gracious enough to knock 30% off the price of that trip. It's coming up New Year's weekend. It's a manifestation weekend. So not only is it a ghost hunting weekend, but they'll focus on manifestation weekend. So, hey, you're looking to change the way you're doing things for the new year. Come on up to the Palmer and get 30% off. So check that out as well. Makes a great holiday gift. All right, we're going to get out of here. Have a great weekend, everybody. Take care of yourself. Take care of your loved ones. Take care of somebody who you might not even know. Take care of a stranger. We'll see you back here next week for the best in true crime and paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
Get ready for July 4th with early savings at Lowe's. Get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on South High Street in Columbus.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com. Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or jeffweilercolumbusautomall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.